It's All Things Considered from North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. No, we do not have a budget yet. No, we are not particularly close. Yes, we're going to sift into some of what didn't happen this week at your North Carolina General Assembly. The conversation, as usual, is between Becky Gray from the Conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield with the Progressive NC Policy Watch. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hiya, guys.
Lots of grandstanding, letters going back and forth between legislative leaders and the governors. We saw a temporary stopgap partial spending measure. Also, an adjournment resolution could soon send lawmakers home for a month and bring them back right before Labor Day. There were some controversial and noteworthy pieces of legislation that emerged this week at the legislature, only to be tabled. Medicaid is still the 600,000-pound elephant in the room. Governor Cooper wants it. Phil Berger has seemingly no interest in expanding. Rob, what I'm still trying to understand is where the governor has real leverage here. The government is not shut down. It's not going to shut down. I'm wondering if you think this is a viable strategy for Cooper to just keep hammering on the clean Medicaid expansion front.
Well, I mean, I think it's the morally correct position to be taking. I'm no political strategist. I think the governor's doing what he thinks is the right thing to do. I think he genuinely believes this would be better for the state. Remains to be seen. I mean, we saw this week a vote where several Republicans in the House came along. I think it's clear that a majority of both bodies would vote for some kind of Medicaid expansion. I really do think that Phil Berger is continuing to sort of paint himself into a corner where he's sort of getting lonelier and lonelier in his opposition. So, you know, I don't know. Cooper's been around a long time. He's a smarter political analyst than I am, and I defer to his judgment on this, but I think there's no doubt that he's taking the best position for the state of North Carolina.
Well, Rob is correct. He's not a political analyst. Neither am I. So, and don't really tout that as our expertise. However, that's never stopped us in our candid conversations from talking about those things.
So, Becky, who is it incumbent upon to take the first step? We got a lot of big boy pointing back and forth. We need somebody to saddle up and make the first phone call or text message or significant offer of a deal here. There's no indication we're getting that anytime
soon. There have been deals that have been offered. The problem is the deals have not been accepted. And as sort of this bravado that we're seeing play out exactly as you have described, you know, the deals have been made and the other side has said, well, that's not a deal. That's not a compromise. And so, you know, we haven't gotten to a middle ground with it yet. But there are deals that are being put out. Of course, what you're seeing evolve over this week is a lot of things in the conference budget, the General Assembly's budget, if you will not happen if the veto is not overridden, if that budget is not put into place, that I think is putting some pressure on, whether it's putting some pressure on lawmakers, but it's certainly contributing to the discussion. But it comes down to, Jeff, as you described, more and more, this has really become a battle about Medicaid expansion. I mean, that's where it begins and that's where it ends.
I think it's important, though, to note that the governor put forth, I think, a pretty comprehensive proposed compromise on a lot of issues. And there are a lot of problems he has with the budget proposal. Frankly, from the perspective of progressives, we had a lot of problems with the governor's proposal initially. We thought there were a lot of shortcomings there. The governor's conceded that he thinks there could be more tax cuts, which is something I think progressives think is a mistake. There's lots of concessions the governor's offered, and yet he has identified. And the other thing I want to make a point of is that it seems to me, although I think there is a lot of bravado, Cooper's tone has been much more measured and tempered. Berger sort of emotes anger in his statements. It's like he's almost, you know, just can't control himself with the feelings that he has about this. It's surprising to me that he doesn't play it a little cooler.
Would you agree with that or not?
Jeff, you're in this building a lot, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the frustration level has escalated, through all of this.
Yes, ma'am.
And
well,
so, how cool can you play it? And then you have to be, you know, what does the media pick up on and how do they portray it? And it just seems to feed this whole, again, the bravado and the going back and forth and the kind of going to your corners and the accusations that have been made. One thing that I thought was interesting was this week during the debate on the supplemental stopgap budget, House Bill 111 that now is over in the Senate. But during that discussion, and it went on for a long time, mm-hmm. the debate on that, and there were accusations. There was finger pointing, there was finger wagging, there was all kinds of going back and forth with it. But when the vote was taken, there was one no vote. It was almost unanimous. So, you know, that's maybe everybody has to get in their, you know, their points and then move towards it. But it just keeps coming back to the question of Medicaid expansion. The governor has said the whole deal is on this. The General Assembly is saying, wait a minute, no. And there's all these other things in the budget that are at risk.
I don't think the General Assembly is saying that. I think Phil Berger's saying that. I think it was clear this week when we had an overwhelming vote in support of a Medicaid expansion bill in a House committee for the first time that there is a clear majority in the House, and I dare say in the Senate as well, that would be happy to vote for some version of Medicaid expansion. And I really think that a lot of what's going on here right now is that there's been a sea change. Phil Berger's been basically in charge for 8 years. He hadn't had to deal with this kind of thing. And it's got to be maddening. I'm sure he was used to having his way. And now the fact that he's actually got to negotiate, and now that he's in Germany, it makes it a lot tougher. I can understand it would be frustrating after having been sort of had unfettered control over things for such a long time.
So inside baseball and going candidly off script a little bit for a moment here, I want to ask you both about the Medicaid expansion bill. It's known as Carolina Cares. It's effectively Medicaid expansion. But to your point, Rob, as you just alluded to, it overwhelmingly was approved in a House Health Committee this week.
25-6, I think.
This is the first time Medicaid expansion has been approved in any committee or subcommittee or research group or anything in the time that the Republicans have been in control here. I thought it was interesting that it was very much a false start from my perspective. It moved through this committee. It's on the floor of the House for the full body and then nothing. And as we talk here at the end of the week, it's not going to move through either chamber. It just seemed weird to me that they kind of they revved up this race car or this call it whatever you want. They revved it up and then it just stopped. I think that if they were to put Medicaid expansion on the floor, the full House floor, it would pass. I think it would probably pass, certainly with a majority, but with a majority of Republicans as well. Do you think, Becky, because I know you're opposed to Medicaid expansion, do you think that would be a good development for this greater conversation about the budget if the House were to say, hey, here's where we stand on this. Senate, it's your turn to weigh in.
Well, you know, I think that that is part of this. I think the reality of it is the Medicaid expansion and the veto override, those two things are very closely tied together. You know, part of this is trying to sort of put olive branches out to the other side. You know, we'll concede on Medicaid expansion. How serious are you about veto overriding the governor's veto? So you've sort of seen this dance back and forth with the two. The two things are not unconnected.
They're not. But can we all agree here that the premise of Republicans telling Democrats, hey, if you vote for this override, we're going to pass Medicaid expansion. Can we all agree that's kind of foolish? That ain't going to happen.
We don't know whether it's going to not happen. I mean, I think that, you know, in this day and time.
I mean, the notion that we're going to there's a promise to talk about it later and that ought to be sufficient to make the Democrats happy. I mean, come on. Let's have a real, honest negotiation. That's what people voted for. They know there's divided government. Let's have the governor, Democratic leaders, Republican leaders all get down in a room and hash this thing out. There's clearly some common ground on almost all of these issues. Let's do it and stop this nonsense where we have to posture with each other.
One thing that I will say, Jeff, is, you know, I work at a think tank. I think that the more discussion, the more debate, the more voices you have, no matter what the issue, is healthier and better for the outcome, even on issues that the majority party, whoever that may be at any particular time, things that they don't agree with. I think that some of these ideas, and, you know, to be honest with you, I think some of these progressive ideas that have been brought forward, I think they should be discussed. I think they should be open to the public. I think that it serves everyone better to have more discussion. So no matter what the political ties or implications or underpinnings of this may be this week, I think it's been healthy to have this discussion.
The budget impasse consumes a lot of the air in the room. It's literally getting warmer in the studio as we talk about it. Something else, one other piece of legislation from each of you that moved or didn't move. We talked about Medicaid and the budget, but other than those two, something else that perhaps was missed and is not getting a lot of attention because of those two things that are consuming a lot of the air in the room. Something from each of you from this week.
I mean, there's one that we agree on, which is this Second Chance Act that's passed the Senate unanimously. It came out of a House committee unanimously with the ACLU, the NAACP, ALEC, Koch Industries. I mean, come on, Americans for Prosperity, the prosecutors in the state, all on board on this plan. It's it appears now to be caught up once again in sort of these machinations where Berger and Moore kind of, you know, play chess with each other as to who's going to let whose bill go forward. That's one that's would do enormous good in our state. It would give thousands of people to get a clean slate, people with past criminal records, and it's supported by everybody. It's something that clearly needs to go through before adjournment.
I've got one, but just to kind of piggyback on Rob's, another thing that is not the same but related is a criminal law reform that would begin to organize, clean up, fix our convoluted criminal code. It's criminal law reform that's been moving through, and that's another positive step in making some sense, simplifying our criminal code system. So I wanted to mention that. But the other thing, and it is getting some attention, but I think it's really significant, are these ABC bills, the reforms to the ABC laws in North Carolina. There's a combination. Two of the bills have been blended together. A lot of this at this point is dealing with distilleries and craft distilleries in North Carolina that really make their product more marketable, will offer more choice for consumers, and really treat distilleries in very much the same way that our craft breweries have been treated. And we see the growth in that. So I think that's a very positive thing. And when the session's all over, I think when we look back at the reforms to the ABC system, whether it's being able to serve alcohol at sporting events or whether it's raising the threshold for distribution for craft beer or these loosening of the regulations for distilleries, I think we'll see some really significant changes in the ABC laws in North Carolina that, again, offer consumers more choice, more opportunities for investment and economic growth and those kind of things, which I think is a really good policy movement.
The fight over partisan gerrymandering continues next week when a trial begins in North Carolina. This state case comes less than a month after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that partisan challenges will not be heard by the federal bench. This state case has the potential to significantly alter how political maps are established in North Carolina and also could serve as somewhat of a blueprint for legal challenges in other American states. Or it could result in the latest affirmation of partisan gerrymandering, an American tradition in politics that stretches back more than two centuries. Ultimately, we do think that this is going to get elevated to the state Supreme Courts before a three-judge panel next week. At the state Supreme Court, six Democrats, one Republican, and the conventional wisdom is that these maps are going to go bye-bye. But we've seen Wisconsin, and we've seen the North Carolina case go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Are supporters of this challenge being overly optimistic?
I think that the supporters obviously were bitterly disappointed that the Supreme Court came down and punted on this issue. I think Justice Roberts' opinion was, a terrible one and very disappointing. But even Roberts, in upholding partisan gerrymandering in terms of federal constitutional principles, invited the states to do something about it, said that this was something that states needed to take action on, opened the door, I think, clearly to state Supreme Courts taking action. And I think, it's hard to predict, and one would suspect and hope that it's not a partisan matter. I think it ought to be a bipartisan matter, redistricting reform and the end of gerrymandering. I think there is some hope that the Supreme Court will do the right thing, that they will find that the North Carolina Constitution prevents this, prescribes it. And if that happens, that could be a real game changer in the state. And a lot of people have their fingers crossed.
And of course, what this case is about, different than the federal court, is does our state constitution have different protections than the U.S. Supreme Court has determined the federal constitution has? So the hope, of course, and the expectation is that the court will interpret the state constitution by the letter of the law. It's kind of ironic to me that the plaintiffs in this case are counting on the Democrats on the state Supreme Court to be partisan on this very partisan question.
I don't think they're counting on them to be partisan. I think they're counting on them to be
And maybe that's partisan. Just the pundits that I'm listening
sure.
to. But, you know,
I haven't heard anybody from Common Cause is clearly, they think that this is a more favorable bench. But I haven't heard anyone say, we've got Democrats, therefore.
And they tried to get Democrats to do redistricting reform when the Democrats were in control.
But that, even in the introduction, Jeff, you mentioned six Democrats on the bench, one Republican. So,
it's a relevant note,
the partisan question and poll has been part of, see, what do you think they're going to do?
Just
you know, that's
as the
been
high
part
court
exactly,
is a 5-4 split,
exactly.
Right?
Yes, okay. exactly. Right. And you know, the questions at the on the federal court, you know, were the same thing. But the thing that Rob and I think we can agree with on this is that we do need redistricting reform. And, you know, one way to do that is to make sure that the rules are strict enough that there's not the wiggle room to do these different things, and that parties can't be subject, parties can't use the system to their advantage, that the rules are in play so that it creates a more fair playing field so that voters and individuals are picking their elected officials.
Last topic. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, instead of the other way around.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
which politicians
right,
pick
yes.
their voters.
Last topic, on to the latest in the Cody Henson saga. The House Republican from Transylvania County got another continuance in his criminal trial this week. Henson faces charges of cyberstalking against his wife. Back in February, a judge issued a year-long domestic order against Henson. On Tuesday, the extension to the criminal proceedings took place because his lawyer said he needed to be in Raleigh. Then on Wednesday, in what I view as truly painful irony, the House unanimously passed a bill pertaining to existing laws about domestic violence protection orders. Henson did not cast a vote. Right. Why is this guy still serving in the state legislature?
That's, you know, that's a good question. I mean, you know, until he resigns that seat, he was elected. I mean,
I get the fundamental
right.
mechanism of it,
but you
why
know,
hasn't he resigned?
I don't know. That's a good question. My advice to him would be, you know, let's put everybody out of their misery. But until he gets pressure, I'm guessing from his constituents and the people at home, you know, he can continue to serve. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, the person who has it in his power to do something is House Speaker Tim Moore, and it's also the Republican leadership, all of whom contributed to his campaign. There's actually some large corporations also that contributed to Henson's campaign. They all ought to call him up. Moore ought to have a press conference and say, it's over, man. The Henson has already stated he's not going to run for re-election. He's a lame duck. He's obviously not in a position to receive. Could you imagine a constituent going to talk to him about domestic violence after he's, you know, facing criminal charges on it? It's a ridiculous state of affairs. He should have resigned months ago, and Moore and leadership should be demanding it.
Well, let's not forget too that, I mean, his trial has not begun yet. I mean, he has been accused of these things, but there's, you know, he has not been convicted of anything. And so, you know, I mean, still, the last time I checked, you're still innocent until proven guilty. He feels like he is in capacity to serve. His constituents believe he's in a capacity to serve. We have an election in a year and a half.
Not right around the corner. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your weekends.
Thanks, you
Stay
too.
Stay cool, guys.